8032. The Finance Committee meets this month on August 23rd at Cider Riot at 807 Northeast Cooch.
Well, good morning. This is KBOO, your radio station, and this is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fagre, and I thought we'd start the day off with a little laugh. We have Secretary of Defense Mattis saying that Putin, President of Russia, is trying to, quote, undermine America's moral authority. And, well, you know, just a few days ago, we had this story, a horrible story of U.S. bombs killing school children in Yemen. And we might just go back through history, how many governments, many of them democracies, had the U.S. overthrown. So when Mattis talks about America's moral authority, it's just kind of hurts to laugh, but that's what you got to do. The U.S. has been, Donald Trump, his weird way, has continued a long process of imposing economic sanctions on America's perceived enemies, in this case, Russia. And, which is actually an act of war, many people have observed. One writer is Max Blumenthal, and he gave an interview on Real News, which you can catch on, go online and get the Real News. It's there's some good stuff there. The interviews with different people. I had an interview with Max Blumenthal, and he says that these Russia sanctions came as sort of a surprise. And they were based, sort of, the justification, so-called, forward. It was based on the poisoning of the Russian double agent, Sergei Skripal, in England. And, which is a pretty flimsy, it seems very weird to me. I mean, that case has been around now since March 4th, I believe. And now, in that time, the case, the whole story has kind of fallen apart. And all of a sudden, Donald Trump is jumping into it, using that as an excuse for new sanctions on Russia. Well, what's wrong with the Skripal case? Well, one is that Britain announced a verdict within days of its happening. Meanwhile, And I think over 100 Russian diplomats are expelled from England and the U.S. and a few other countries. But as of today, the investigation is still going on. In other words, there really is no official verdict. There is the allegations that Theresa May has made and other people in the British government. But the investigation is still going on. There are lots of holes in the official story. One is that this is a nerve agent. How come Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia are still alive? And there's an article by Seymour Hersh saying that if it was really a nerve agent, many people, probably half the town of Salisbury, would be dead. The other thing is that this so-called nerve agent, which goes by the Russian name Novichok, which includes a whole lot of different chemicals, This was developed by the Soviets back in the 50s or 60s, but it's not that they have a monopoly on it. A lot of other countries have this nerve agent, including Great Britain, and it's not a secret. The one of the developers of it published a formula for it on the internet, so it's like the secret is out. Almost anyone with a well-equipped laboratory could make this stuff. So to hang it all on Russia because they developed back in the Soviet days is really is not very logical. Interesting thing about the whole case is that Sergei Skripal, when he was living in Salisbury, this is the same town as a fellow named Pablo Miller, who was the British intelligence guy who recruited Skripal back in about 20 years ago. And also when Skripal was also in connected with Christopher Steele, another British intelligence guy who was the author of the famous or infamous Trump dossier. And so anyway, according to Max Blumenthal, they use this flimsy pretext to carry out a sort of a hybrid warfare on Russia. And the goal is to get, supposedly, sanctions will get the ordinary people to get them riled up and get them mad enough to remove Putin from office. Well, it seems to be backfiring right now. It's backfiring in Iran also. And instead of bowing down to the U.S., Russia and Iran are drawing closer to China and other nations. So Europe, which has a thing to remember about the Iran sanctions, is that the U.S. withdrew from the nuclear agreement that was reached with Iran, which is still in effect. Iran has been following this agreement, as have the other signatories, which are some of the European countries and Russia. So it's the U.S. has backed out of this. The U.S. is sort of the lone wolf in this case, has backed out of this nuclear agreement, supposedly, according to Trump, in his weird, twisted way, thinks that by backing out of one agreement, you can get the other party to agree to another agreement. Well, lots of luck, Donald. Another person who has weighed in on this thing is Stephen Cohen, who has been a guest on this show several times. He's a professor of history at New York University and Princeton, and he is an authority on Russia and the Soviet Union. According to Stephen Cohen, he does a kind of a weekly conversation with John Batchelor. Now, I'm not sure where you can hear that. I think John Batchelor is with NBC, but I hear it, I see it, it's a video on the internet. So if you go online, you can catch Stephen Cohen's weekly chats with John Batchelor. And Cohen says that the sanctions do have a long history. You know, they go way back to right after the Russian Revolution 100 years ago. But he says, and this is a quote, that the U.S. sanctions on Russia are, quote, akin to temper tantrums or road rage. And that's a good description. And they just, according to Cohen, they make things worse. Michael McFaul, who was the U.S. ambassador to Russia, he says that the U.S., I think he's back in the, at a university, he's a professor somewhere, and he says that the U.S. does not need Russia. Well, this is kind of foolish, because I think the U.S. does need Russia in many, many ways. In just one very simple way is that the Russians supply rocket engines for our space program. They also supply titanium, which is a metal that's necessary for airplanes and space ventures. And they allow, when the U.S. Resupplies its troops in Afghanistan, they actually go through Russian territory. So in lots of different ways, Russia is helping out the U.S. and can withhold that help. They could, Russian territory covers a whole lot of the globe, and they could very easily refuse to allow American aircraft into their airspace, which would kind of really mess up our commercial airliners, their schedules. So, and in a way, the sanctions are helping, according to Stephen Cohen, the sanctions are helping Putin. For one thing, the Russian economy, like many in the world, is not doing so well. And when you have sanctions, whether it's justified or not, the leaders of that sanctioned country can say they can blame the sanctions for the economic performance. And another way sanctions are helping Putin is that for a long time he has been trying to persuade the Russian oligarchs, a lot of whom are living abroad, they stashed their money abroad, and Putin has been trying to get them to bring their money home where it can be put to use within Russia and be subject to taxation. Well, with sanctions imposed by President Trump, these oligarchs apparently are having second thoughts. Their wealth, which they have stashed abroad, may not be so safe after all. So apparently some of the oligarchs are bringing their money home. If anyone wants to weigh in on this, the number to call is 503-231-8187. What do you think of these sanctions? What do you think of our whole thing with Russia? Do you think Russia is undermining America's moral authority, as Mad Dog Mattis has said? Give us a call. The Sergei Skripal poisoning brings up another interesting case. One of the Russian oligarchs. One thing to remember is when we talk about Russian oligarchs, they were created. They came into being quite a long time before Putin became president of Russia. The oligarchs appeared back in the days of Boris Yeltsin, when he became president of Russia around 1991 or so, and he kind of opened the doors for Western financial interests to buy up Russian assets on the cheap. That's how these Russian oligarchs got so wealthy. But we do have a caller. Jack is on the air. Good morning, Jack.
Yeah, this Russiagate thing is just becoming sort of quite incredible in the purest sense of the word.
Incredible is right, yes.
Yeah, it's, what you keep hearing are accusations and broad-based assumptions, but you never see any evidence. And it's bizarre that, it's become a meme that just won't go away. I think a couple of weeks ago, I heard somebody on national propaganda radio refer to the Skripals as having been murdered.
They're still alive.
They're not dead, but nevertheless, that's the meme. It's out there, and they're just going to roll with it. And I never heard a correction about it. It just, that was what they said.
Well, they shouldn't be alive. If it was a real nerve agent, they would be dead along with a lot of other people in that town. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. So this thing is just become amazing. The justification for this the justification for this whole agenda with Russia seems to fall back again and again and again to Crimea. Mm-hmm. And but the discussion is never held in the public arena in the U.S. anyway, the fact that there was a plebiscite. Now, if they want to challenge the authenticity of the plebiscite, that's one thing. But they don't even talk about the plebiscite. And the mm-hmm. plebiscite, and in the plebiscite, I think it was something about close to 97% mm-hmm. of the Crimeans chose to rejoin the Russian Federation in whatever their relationship is, and basically reject the neo-fascists in Kiev.
Well, one thing, let's do a little bit of quick history here. Crimea became a part of Russia back in the 1700s, I believe, under Catherine the Great, and it's been Russian territory ever since. Then in 1954, Nikita Khrushchev sort of turned over Crimea to Ukraine. Of course, at that time, both were part of the Soviet Union, so it's more of an administrative thing. But Khrushchev never asked the Crimeans what they thought of this. He just kind of gave it away to Ukraine. And then, of course, Ukraine, when the Soviet Union broke up, Ukraine became independent. So that's how they gained the Crimea. And, you know, there's always been this kind of a tension or sort of a conflict between what they call territorial integrity and self-determination. You know, all over the world, borders are created by war. Something going on back there?
Oh, just cooking breakfast.
Okay. All right. And there's always been this tension between territorial integrity and self-determination. And you look at how borders are created by war, political chicanery, and all kinds of things, and borders do get changed in different ways. And it's a kind of a conflict that's never been really satisfactorily resolved. You know, the U.S. helped change the borders of Yugoslavia back in the 90s, and they helped create the nation of Kosovo, which had been part of Serbia. That was a change in borders, but with less justification, actually, than Crimea. And actually, if you think about Ukraine, from what I can tell is that Ukraine, you know, there have always been Ukrainian people, Ukrainian language and culture, but for centuries, Ukraine was part of larger empires. There was a Polish-Lithuanian empire back in the Middle Ages, and Ukraine was part of that. Ukraine actually never became independent or got its own borders until, I think, 1922, when they were sort of created by the Bolsheviks. And the borders sort of lumped the Ukrainians in, along with a lot of ethnic Russians into one territory. So, you know, you can see why there'll be a lot of tension between these two sort of two nations within one country. So anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, well, thanks very much for the history update. That's you know, you can count on the mainstream narrative not to allow any history to get in the way of its agenda, though. I would remind people that you know, these borders have changed so severely over the centuries. At one time, this Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth extended from the Baltic to the Black Sea.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And,
yes.
Yeah, and but you know, the things change, and you know, there are different alignments and so forth. Other analysts have gone so far as to point to the breakup of the Balkans as being a global intelligence operation mm-hmm. aimed at completely breaking up Russia.
That's right. That was the ultimate goal, I think. You know, Serbia was Russia's main ally there. Of course, Yugoslavia was kind of a Soviet ally, but they had a very independent streak, and they sort of like a bridge between East and West. And And the U.S. decided, I guess, back in the 90s that, you know, Yugoslavia had served its purpose or didn't have a purpose anymore. And so the U.S. encouraged all these separate parts of Yugoslavia to separate. And that's what happened. And, you know, it had been a pretty peaceful country right up until the Civil War when all hell broke loose. And the reason was to kind of take Serbia and Yugoslavia down a peg and also open up some of these new countries to Western bases. You know, Kosovo and Albania, you know, are part of the Western alliance now, along with, I think, Slovenia and Croatia. And so there's all kinds of... The ultimate goal, I think, was to go after Russia, encourage a breakup of Russia, which is a federation, too, somewhat like Yugoslavia was.
Right. Well, anyway, who knows what's going to become of it. Let's hope cooler heads prevail.
Well, I hope so, too. Thanks for your call.
You bet.
Mm-hmm. Jack was talking about, you know, the evidence for some of the stuff you hear on the radio, on NPR. One case is the this whole thing about Russian meddling in our 2016 elections. And one thing that does not get mentioned is the William Binney was 30 years with the NSA, and he said that, and he gave evidence that the DNC material that was revealed was not hacked by anybody. It was leaked, and the evidence was the time it took for this material to download. If it had been hacked, it would not have it could not have happened in the time elapsed. It had to be a leak from within the DNC, within the Democratic Party, and somebody turn that material, probably put it on a thumb drive, and turn it over to WikiLeaks. So this is what William Binney says. He is a credible person, and he presents evidence. But okay, how has the mainstream media, including NPR, responded to this? They have ignored it. They have not contradicted it. They have not given evidence against it. They have just ignored it as though it had never been said. And this is just bad journalism. Shame on NPR. Shame on the New York Times and Washington Post. So they have ignored this this evidence. The other thing to keep in mind is that the material that was leaked consisted, as far as I can tell, of Hillary Clinton's speeches to the Wall Street banking community, and also material about how the Democratic National Committee messed around with Bernie Sanders' campaign. Well, both of those things, nobody has said that the material was false. I mean, the material was true. Not only was it true, it's material that the American people had a right to know. So whoever leaked this material was doing Americans a big favor. We learned a little bit more about how our political system operates. So keeping those two things in mind, they have never really been disputed. That leaves this whole case, and I'm still trying to figure this out, the whole thing about trolls getting messages onto social media. I don't quite understand how that is done, but from what I can tell, some of these messages, are not very persuasive. I've seen some of the things they put on social media, like one had Jesus arm wrestling with the devil or something like that. If that kind of stuff can sway American voters, to throw an election, that kind of calls in question what our American voters are. They that gullible? Are they that naive? Are they that ignorant? I mean, it just seems a little preposterous to me. But if somebody has a better idea on that, they can always give us a call at 503-231-8187. We have a few minutes left in this show. I'd love to hear from you. But this story just does not go away. It keeps getting repeated without any evidence. And the real evidence that sort of that goes against the story is ignored. And so this is kind of taken a life of its own. Before we wrap up here, I'd like to present one other person who's been a guest on this show a few times, is Pepe Escobar. Now, he's a Brazilian journalist who writes for Asia Times and other outlets. And he's covered Asia now for quite a while, and he's been writing a lot about the Chinese New Silk Roads Initiative. And what this is it goes back to a theory that a British thinker named Halford Mackinder had about over 100 years ago, that there's a huge Eurasian heartland. For centuries, this was sort of the center of world civilization until around 1500, when the Europeans got into navigation and started acquiring colonies in what was then called the New World. And this led to basically to imperialism as we know it today, which is on the wane. It's kind of seeing the end of its days. And the theory of the new heartland is that the world is reverting back to what it was before this European sort of explosion of conquest. And according to Pepe Escobar, the Chinese New Silk Roads Initiative is part of that, that they are establishing high-speed rail and road networks all throughout, from China into Siberia, Russia, all the Turkic nations there, and that this is sort of a coming power in the world that is being born right now, and Russia is part of that, and also it includes Iran, and the Silk Roads even extend into Africa, and of course they include Europe. Right now you can take a high-speed train from the coast of China to Portugal, and it takes about half the time that it would take to go by ship. In the energy-constrained world that we are moving into, I think aviation will be soon become a thing of the past, that transportation will be either by rail or by boat. And so when the U.S. is trying to fight this this kind of this, you might call this a real New World Order, and basically the U.S. is fighting geography. When you look at a map of the world, you see where nations, where people are living side by side, and where their commerce and their will take them. And so we have a kind of rebirth of of ancient civilizations, and it's kind of it has a momentum of its own, and the U.S. as being the number one power in the world is definitely at the end of its days, and you can look at the sanctions that we are imposing on Russia and several other nations, not just Russia. You can look at those sanctions as a kind of a has-been fighter throwing one last punch before he goes down for the count. Anyway, this has been Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fagerheim. Happy to be with you. Stay tuned for KBOO, your radio station.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society's new concert season, which starts September 21st of this year and runs through May of 2019, all staged at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. The Portland Folk Music Society is pleased to present a lineup of national and regional artists, including Molly O'Brien and Rich Moore, the Kathy Kallick Band, the Honey Whiskey Trio, Legends of the Celtic Harp with Patrick Ball, True North, Tish Hinojosa, Pat Donahue, Nina Gerber and Chris Webster, and Dave Stamey. And for the first time, the Portland Folk Music Society is offering season ticket packages at prices below single show rates, either online or at the door. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and look on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.